Thanks. So last time we talked about electrons, basically the properties of non-interacting electrons. Today I'd like to talk about motion in a periodic potential. But before we start that, let me just back up a second and mention one other thing. Jonathan, where is Jonathan? Okay, asked me the other day what he could read about or what references I was using, and the answer that I gave him I think wasn't quite right. So let me put it this way. For what we're doing, what we did in the last class, and for what we're doing today, you can look at pretty much any condensed matter physics book that's ever been written, and you'll find that stuff in it. Okay. So I've actually posted on the wiki a little document on books in condensed matter theory. And it starts out with a list that I actually cribbed from some place that's all the traditional books. But what I would say is that as we get into more interesting or more sophisticated stuff, I'll probably be using more modern books. And so I've added that at the bottom. So for instance, there's books by Fradkin. There's a book by Xiaogang Wen, not the one that he used for your course, but the one that's published on quantum money-body theory. We have a couple of copies here. I'll probably almost certainly use that for the discussion of Fermi liquid theory. There's a book that we're going to get by Bruce and Felsberg, which has quantum many-body theory in it, and so forth. So as time goes on, you'll see, I'll probably continue to annotate that list, because basically when I do these lectures, I've got this big pile of books and I'm trying to find the one that does things in a way that I'm comfortable with, and so I'll let you know. Okay, so going back to motion in a periodic potential. So so periodic potential has translational symmetry. And so we're in condensed matter. This is a discrete symmetry, okay? The translation is a translation by one lattice constant, or whatever, or some multiple of that. So we're looking at discrete symmetries. And so you have some, and they form a group, which is a translation group for the system, in which we can write that as a set of translation operators. Let's write them like this. So where this vector is a translation vector, sorry, there's some badly written symbol, yeah, semicolon. Just as bad. Anyway, it's a semicolon. Bad notation. So, and now I've written this in a way that we're using the periodic boundary conditions. So, so the idea here is that the translation that corresponds to, say, L0, 0 is equal to the identity. which you could just well write as 000 if you like, no translation at all. Okay, so I basically I built into this period, which is good for translational symmetry because you like to be able to just keep going. Okay, now these vectors A, B, and C. Are called, I believe, primitive translation vectors. And they have to satisfy A dot. But it's actually is equal to the volume of the unit cell. So this is for three dimensions. Obviously, they can't be collinear. The unit cell has to have some volume. Everything that I'm going to say in the next few minutes, you can do actually for two dimensions. You just pretend that there's a third direction, C, which is perpendicular to the two-dimensional layer, and everything works out fine. So this is an abelian group. All of the translations commute. All of the irreducible representations of this group are one-dimensional. Now, does everyone understand that? Good. Okay. That's a little bit of group theory jargon. So now let's first look at functions with the symmetry of the group. What do we call it? G. Sorry, I'm calling it G. So if you have a function, let's call it phi of r, which is completely symmetric under this discrete group of translations, then if you operate on it, okay, so that's what we mean. And that means we can then represent that function as a Fourier sum. Let's call it F. For Fourier coefficient. Okay, and now I have to tell you what these Qs are. So these Qs have to have the property that when you when R is a lattice vector, that this is equal to 2 pi times an integer. And coming back to here, so this sum is over all possible such vectors Q. I'll tell you which ones are possible. So then Q is equal to L A plus MB plus MC, where these are integers. And A is equal to 2 pi B cross C over A dot B plus C. And so you can see right away that A dot little a is 2 pi, and A dot B or A dot C is 0. Okay. And B and C are given by et cetera, cyclic permutations of this. Chris?
What's wrong with just taking an orthogonal basis?
Because all lattices don't do that. In a sense, we are creating a, the translational symmetry of a crystal isn't necessarily, or how should I say it? All crystal lattices are not cubic.
Not all crystal
lattices. So that's why. Simple as that. Okay, these they're called reciprocal lattice vectors. And clearly, from this definition, they themselves form a periodic lattice in a different space, which is a reciprocal space. Okay, it has units of inverse length. Okay, so that's all we have to say about functions that have the symmetry of the translation group. Now let's look at the eigenfunctions of the translation group, of the translation operators. So these will be functions which do not have the symmetry of the group, but are eigenfunctions of the translation operator. I mean, this, in a sense, is an eigenfunction of the translation operator with eigenvalue 1. These other eigenfunctions So when you translate these guys, you don't get back what you started with, but you get back what you started with multiplied by a phase. Okay? And the phase k, e to the ik dot r, this k is uniquely associated, this eigenvalue, as always with eigenvalues, uniquely associated with its eigenfunction. Yeah, thank you. For periodic boundary conditions, these k's satisfy the following. I suppose we could have been a little bit more general and had a different number of unit cells in the different directions. Akosa. Well, see, these guys are a multiple, an integer multiple, of the basic reciprocal lattice vectors. And these guys are a fraction. So if you like, these k's interpolate between the q's. So if you put the k's and the q's together, you cover all of reciprocal space. I mean, that's a slightly sloppy statement, because the way that I've written this, this k could be a q if L, M, and N are multiples of big L. But you get the idea. This then represents a subset. Yeah. Oh, sorry. And in fact, these things, as I said, I should have put a little subscript for the, which, because they don't have to. You know, you have a crystal, say, that's made on a hyper torus or whatever it is, and it doesn't have to have the same number of steps around in each of the crystalline directions. So I could have been a little bit more general here. Would have also cleaned up the notation. But. Yeah.
Can you drawing a little picture of what it looks like?
Why are we restricted to considering only modulo one eigenvalues?
Because of the periodic boundary condition. That's what you mean, right? In other words, why are these things going in integral units?
No, I mean, why e to the I k r, why not a real component?
These things are unitary, one-dimensional unitary transformations. So I think they can only have.
So these are wave functions.
These are.
I thought these.
No, but the no. Well, these are symmetry operations.
Okay. Right.
So I think that they themselves are unitary transformations in one-dimensional case. That's all you can have. Yeah.
Well, actually, you just need to use the periodic boundary conditions to say that any translation, if you do it L times,
you get one. Yeah, so, yeah. That's right. Yeah, try putting in a constant here. I guess that's what you're saying.
Second.
So I think what Bruno's saying is try putting in a constant here and then try to make a group out of it. You go around and you pick up a factor of A, and it's not going back into itself, if you see what I mean. So it's got to be
Why do we have to come back to ourselves? Like, are we? If you're on an infinite lattice, you can translate as many times as you want, and you'll keep getting different things.
Yeah, but if you want to see how that's going to work, put it with periodic boundary conditions. Because so what that's telling you is that as you go around, it's getting bigger and bigger in amplitude. It's like if you're going out, it's getting bigger and bigger. It's not a translation. It's a translation and a dilation. What else did I want to say here? Yeah. Okay. So you understand
Okay. So these L's here, all those can be
zero to L minus one, if you like. Okay. Because if you go to L, you sort of get back to zero. On the other hand, it's a bit arbitrary what the range is for these things. Sorry.
When we express that as a Fourier series,
yep.
Do we have any conditions of the periodicity of F, which is the function of the reciprocal functions?
These guys?
Yes.
Just the ones that give you this, I would think. You might say if this is a real function, then f of q equals f of minus q or something like that.
Can we say f of q is equal to f of q plus r?
No, no, those aren't the same dimensions. Q and R are in different spaces.
Okay.
Okay. So the point that I want to make about this is I could define these integers to go from 0 to L minus 1, but I could equally well define them to go over some translated interval. For instance, L over 2 minus 1 up to 0 up to L over 2. For L even, and the corresponding thing for L odd, which is, did I do this right? Sorry. Minus L over 2 plus 1 up to 0 and then up to L over 2. So I could translate this sum by L. Yeah. This?
Yeah,
the big like on the That's the periodic boundary.
Why is it the same in each direction?
So what's that? I mean, it doesn't have to be the same.
Okay.
So it's just for not to clutter up the notation. Okay. So the point that I'm making is that you can. If you're doing like a computer calculation and you wanted to sum over the allowed values of k, going from 0 to L minus 1 is a very simple thing to do. If you're trying to analyze the symmetry of the problem do other kinds of calculations, you might want to have k go from minus something to plus something. Okay, I'll show you one other possibility. But before I do, I just want to make one other point. There's another way. This is called Bloch's theorem. In physics, which is that. But another way of writing that is to write psi k of r is e to the I k dot r times u k of r, where u k of r So this is a periodic function of R with periodicity of the lattice. This is small r.
Yeah.
So this, if you take this with this property for u, so it says that the wave function, which is an eigenfunction of the translation operator with wave vector k, can be written as a phase factor times a periodic function. That's what this statement says. If you take this and put it into here, you'll find that it is an eigenfunction. You pick out it, that if you add big R to little r, that gives you that extra phase. And nothing changes here. Nothing changes in what's left because of this periodicity. Okay, if you don't, you just try that. Okay, so that's an old. Now, so I mean, it's interesting. You might say, okay, this is a periodic function with a full periodicity of the lattice. Why does it carry this k label? Well, it does carry a k label because it will be different. It will be associated with a k label.
Do you want u to be periodic in R or periodic in L?
I want. No. This function here should have the full translational periodicity of the lattice, not just periodic boundary conditions.
Okay.
If it has that property, then when you add a lattice vector to it, it goes to itself, and the EVI k dot r plus r, part of it comes out and part of it goes back into the function. So now let's just draw reciprocal space. So reciprocal space looks like this. Say that's our origin. That's A. That's B. And so what? Minus A, minus B, B minus A.
Do we need any more?
And so forth. Okay, so that's a little piece of the lattice of reciprocal lattice vectors. Where are the k's? The k's sit in here. If I use this formula. Or if I use this expression, I could pull that little parallelogram back here so that it's centered at the origin. This is a subject. The subject here is Brouwer zones. So if you like, this thing here represents a Brouwer zone. It's a contiguous region of reciprocal space that contains every k vector exactly once, and nothing which is equivalent via a reciprocal lattice vector. Now you might question that slightly, because you might say, oh yeah, but what about these guys over here and these guys over here? They are related by a reciprocal lattice vector. So the point is that if you were counting, you would include these, but not these. So it'd be a half-closed interval. Okay? And believe it or not, counting comes up all the time when you're doing actual calculations and doing in a computer and sums over the Brouwer zone, because you have to, usually, typically you're not working with an infinite number of points, at which case the boundaries wouldn't matter. You're working with a finite number of points, and if you include a point twice, you get the wrong answer. Yes?
Why isn't the folded Brouwer zone a triangle rather than a parallelogram?
Because you have to be able to go the full range of from 0 to k and from 0 to b. I mean, those things, if you had a triangle, say you took, you're saying, well, why don't I just take this?
Yes.
There would be inequivalent, there would be different points that are not related by a reciprocal lattice vector. And all the points that are not related by reciprocal lattice vectors need to be included in order to make the space complete. For, if you like, if you're doing a sum over wave vectors in the Brouwer zone in order to get the whole thing.
This is like the smallest unit cell in reciprocal space.
This is, yeah, but clearly this, okay, so as I said, you could translate this and it wouldn't change the size at all, but it would just change the labeling. You translate it by half of reciprocal aspect. And then just to finish off the subject of Brouwer zones, there is another construction of the Brouwer zone, which has exactly the same property that every wave vector, every k vector is there once, okay? But has an additional nice property that it has like the point symmetry of the Brouwer zone and of the crystal of the translation group and other nice properties. And to get that, you do something called the Wigner-Seitz construction. Okay, and basically what you do there is you draw a line from the origin to every reciprocal lattice point, and then you draw in the perpendicular bisector to that line. So let me try to do that. So here I want to draw in, this is going to be terrible looking, but so here I want to draw in a perpendicular bisector there, and here I want to draw in a perpendicular bisector there. And I'm going to end up with some horrible-looking Groen zone. Draw a perpendicular bisector to here. Draw a perpendicular bisector to here. Draw a perpendicular bisector to here. And then let's see what ugly shape I've gotten. Okay, not very symmetrical looking, but possibly accurate, actually. It might not be too far off. So here, did I miss something? No. Okay. Try this yourself at home, okay? Just doing that construction. But the point is that every point inside this polygon represents a distinct wave vector, and there are no two points that are connected by a reciprocal lattice vector except possibly, well, not possibly, except at the boundaries. For instance, here, to go from here to here, you go by minus v. Okay, and so if you like, only half of the boundaries should be included in this Groen zone, and the other half should be excluded. And then you might wonder about the corners. Okay, and actually there's a very simple rule that you look at a point like here, that point's completely included. Here, this point here is partly included, so I guess it's one-third included or something like that. And so you take two of these points and not the other four. And similarly with the edge is half in, half out. You can always figure out how exactly what points, what number of points to. It doesn't matter which one if they're related by a reciprocal lattice vector because they're equivalent. OK, so Groen zones. Okay. Now, so let me just finish up this subject with a little more group theory. So group theory tells us, I'm not going to do group theory, I'm just going to say the result. So if the Hamiltonian commutes with this group of translation operators, then simultaneously, let's see, simultaneously. So your Hamiltonian and all of your group operators can be diagonalized simultaneously In the case of the translation operators, all of their eigenfunctions and eigenvectors are distinct. Yes, who wants to start here? Yeah, I think you were first.
Good. What does it mean to diagonalize the group in this context? Because the set of all TRs is group GT, as you introduced earlier. So
the set, it is, but the eigenfunctions are these thought functions. Okay, so they're all eigenfunctions of the translation operators. Each one carries its unique eigenvalue, which is labeled with K, and the and R of the translation that is operating on it.
So we're not diagonalizing.
It's the translation group is really easy to yeah.
Can we say that we have a representation of this group, and each group, each representative can be diagonalized simultaneously.
It's one dimensional. Each one is one dimensional. Okay, and so it's like it's done. It's a done problem, if you like. Okay. So yeah.
I was just saying that something for TRs abelian.
It is, yeah. But that's the but point. Translations are abelian. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you have rotations, then you get higher dimensional representations. But translations have this really nice property. But however, the statement about being able to diagonalize things simultaneously, and what I was going to go on to say, is that these translation operators actually provide the quantum numbers. Since these eigenfunctions, these block functions, are eigenfunctions of the translation operator with quantum number k, a wave vector in the Rouen zone, and they also diagonalize the Hamiltonian. They provide the quantum numbers for the states in the Hamiltonian. In other words, every eigenfunction, every state of this translationally symmetric Hamiltonian will carry with it a wave vector k in the Brillouin zone. Okay, one of those k's. Okay, and that may not be enough to diagonalize the Hamiltonian because there may be, if you like, many things in the Hamiltonian that correspond to the same K, but it takes you a long way. Okay. What other point did I want to make about this? Yeah, so one of the things that comes up, if you do computation, you have some Hamiltonian which has some translational symmetry and maybe some other symmetries. Maybe it has complete rotational symmetry. Maybe it has some lattice. Maybe it has some point symmetries. In any case, its eigenvalues, it will often have degenerate eigenvalues. If you stick that Hamiltonian matrix in a computer and you'll get out the right eigenvalues, you'll get out the right degeneracies, but the wave functions might not be what you would expect based on this simple analysis, because computationally, the way you diagonalize a matrix, you don't necessarily take into account the fact that there's this translational symmetry. Okay, so if for instance, wave functions with different values of k are degenerate, your diagonalization routine might give you back wave functions that are some arbitrary oddball mixture of eigenfunctions with different values of k. Because it's only diagonalizing h, it's not diagonalizing these translations. On the other hand, if you start out by labeling your states working in a basis which is labeled by k, then it will sort things out, and you'll get, you know, you'll it actually, and in fact, that can save you a lot of work because it basically amounts to block diagonalizing your Hamiltonian, so that the blocks are blocks that correspond to a particular k, reduces it to a smaller problem. That's the ways that you use symmetry to simplify solving these problems. Okay, so that's translational symmetry. And now I'd like to talk about energy bands for electrons in a lattice. Okay, so if you start out with no lattice potential, or a constant if you like, then your energies we saw and so forth. And if you put the thing in a box with periodic boundary conditions, then you get the k-vectors that we talked about, okay? So now the question is, what's the effect of a periodic potential? Okay, so you can write down your periodic potential very simply. Where Q is summed over all the reciprocal lattice vectors. This is totally general, okay? So that's the most general periodic potential that you can write down. Let's just consider a special case where only two of these V's are non-zero. What do I want to say? Consider okay, and so then we have V of R equals VQ e to the IQ, what am I saying here? I'm just picking a Q in one direction. So let's say QX plus V of minus Q e to the minus IQX. So this is a 1D problem. So this is equal to 2 VQ cos QX plus a phase, where phi is the phase of Q of V. Okay, and actually, I'm going to choose this equal to pi, and then draw a picture. Over 2, is that right? A over 2, A, yeah, that looks good. Yeah, this is A. That's a lattice constant. The minus sign makes it be a minimum here. And Q is just 2 pi over A.
Sorry, what did that mean? Equals tau 1?
That's pi.
Oh, pi, sorry.
I just sort of put the minimum here. I mean, it just fixes the position of the. Okay, so. So, and this here is 2VQ. is the height. So the question is, what happens as you turn this on to these states? Okay, because in the absence of this, if EQ is 0, just k squared over m. And the question is, what happens when you turn this thing on? And so one way of looking at this is to assume that this potential is small. We'll say small with respect to what in a second. And so let's consider the effect in perturbation theory. That's perturbation theory. And so the perturbation, yeah.
Is there a difference between the lattice potential and the periodic potential?
This is a period, yeah. If it's a lattice potential, then it has the periodicity of the lattice, and so it's a periodic potential.
Is the potential from the lattice?
From the lattice, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like the result of all the ions that have arranged themselves into a crystal, plus all the other electrons which have sort of conformed to that, and this one electron that we're looking at because of all these arguments that we tried to make last time as to why you might consider looking at one electron in the average field of all of its other electrons is moving in that periodic potential.
So this would be an approach that we would use for mean fields, is to basically then say, now let's consider.
We will. Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. I think I missed something. At the bottom on the left-hand side, first you have, in the center, the thing, you have VQ and V negative Q. Right, you were pointing to it.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So you have V of R equals VQ plus V negative Q.
Yeah.
And then next, you only have a VQ. So what happened to the V negative Q?
Oh, sorry. I took the phase out. Okay. So these things will be related by complex conjugation if this is a real potential.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and so I took the phase and stuck it into the cosine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why the choice of the phase being equal
to that? Oh, just so that, you know, the phase tells you where this wave is going to sit in your coordinate system. So I just chose it so that it's minus. It's a minimum here. It's totally arbitrary. I could have also move my coordinate system. Well, no, I mean, I can't. It was just for the sake of illustration. OK, so the question is perturbation theory. What's your perturbation? Your perturbation is like this, VQ over epsilon of k plus or minus q minus epsilon of k. Well, you don't need all the vector signs here, but anyway. And the question is that a small perturbation? Okay, and the answer is, well, it depends what k is. Okay, so it's small for k much less than q, because these two things not necessarily. Okay. dq over h bar squared q squared over 2m is small. Okay. So in other words, two states that differ by reciprocal lattice vector q will be very different in energy if the strength of the potential is weak compared to the kinetic energy at a reciprocal lattice vector. Let me just draw a picture here. So if this is k, then this is k plus q. Oh, wow. Picture's not very good. Let's move q over 2 a bit. And this is k minus q.
Is that q over 2?
Q over 2. Okay, and the point is that if V is small compared to either of these energy differences, and this, I'm doing this right. No, this is Q, sorry. Purposes of this argument. Okay. These things are far, are this, these energies are large. If they're large compared to the strength of the potential, then your perturbation theory is fine. So you can ask in perturbation theory, what happens to these states down here due to this potential? Yep.
So why are we comparing VQ to this energy? Why not?
Because this potential scatters electrons from K to K plus or minus Q. Okay, its form is e to the IQ dot R, and that has another piece that's e to the minus IQ dot R. When you look at the matrix elements of that potential, between free electron states, which is where we started, it will scatter you from a state with wave vector k to either k plus q or k minus q.
Okay.
And okay. That's, this is of course the crux of the argument. So thanks for asking.
Okay. So lowercase k is just the wave vector of the electron.
Yeah. And it can be anything, but we're considering various cases. And we're considering the effect of the periodic potential for various cases. First case I want to consider is what happens for k close to 0 when I have a small periodic potential. OK? K is less than q. And the potential is much less than this energy. OK? So does everybody know with me again?
Sorry to keep derailing, but how can we consider the periodic lattice potential to be small and still consider the approximation that the lattice potential is strong enough to trap the majority of the electrons, but leaving this one free to?
Okay, that's actually a more, That's a question that we'll sort of be dealing with for the next couple of lectures.
Okay.
So the point, yeah, I mean, so here we're just saying we're just looking at simple one electron problems.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, that the question of why any of this is small is the big question. Okay. So let's look at the effect of the potential on these states down here and see what they are. And basically what happens in second order perturbation theory is that they'll be lowered . That's just the effect of the repulsion of these energy levels with this one. Okay. And that will have two effects. you're going to get a new epsilon of k, which has shifted actually downward. And the curvature will change. In fact, you know right away which way the curvature is going to change, because the further out, no, actually it's not obvious, but it changes it. It lowers, sorry, it increases the effective mass. Okay, you can do the calculation. So it's a shift and an increased not very much, because this is all perturbative. Yeah?
How did we get the expression?
This?
Yes.
So this is second order perturbation theory. Okay. You've got a matrix element connecting these two states. It's the matrix element squared divided by the energy difference. And similarly here. Okay.
Thanks.
Can I be like all the other guys? Just run 1 minute over time. Although I probably shouldn't, because then I won't get to draw the pictures that explain the next result. So I won't. Yeah.
Have you seen the limit of k much less than zero?
Yeah.
Then each e k plus q would be equal to e k minus q.
Then what?
The e k plus q plus and the e k minus q would be the same that it would be, right?
These two are similar.
Yeah,
one's a little bit larger, one's a little bit smaller. Yeah. So these two terms are comparable in size. They can be comparable, but, you know, too much. Okay, so I think we better start. So so next time, we'll finish up on this nearly free electron, which we're almost finished with, do a little bit of tight binding, and then Hartree Fock. Yeah.
Why can't we fold that parabola into the reduced Bernoulli zone?
You can.
Won't that show
even you? Without any interactions, you can. It's, that's called the virtual crystal, I guess. Yeah, you could label, instead of labeling your parabola with just k, you could label, you could fold everything into the first Bernoulli zone.
And I already mentioned it so that when we draw the bands, you can see the bands open up when you add interaction.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. Yeah, yeah. That's just like 2 steps ahead. OK? Yeah, any other?
Is M star related to the energy?
Yeah, it's related to M, and it's related to V, and H bar squared, Q squared over 2. It's some simple formula that basically says, if I did it correctly in my notes before, it says that 1 over M is 1 over M star. Sorry, 1 over M star is 1 over M minus some small amount that depends on V, Q squared over. That's something you could just work out. Okay, thank you all. See you tomorrow. Oh, wait, tomorrow, Thursday. So everyone should know that I'm lecturing in the third period tomorrow, and Java is lecturing in the second period. It's because we switched times several times, but in the meantime, I made an appointment for tomorrow. So I have to be here at 11.
So what will be the precise time? Because like string theory tends to last.
No, no, he has to stop. He has to stop at precisely now, tomorrow, because I'm going to come in and start lecturing. Okay.
Okay. It's unlikely.
Unlike all other people, and I'm not going to go. 15 minutes. 15 minutes.